Megan? The pitch of his voice raised a little. I took a deep breath. I felt awful. I was acutely aware that what I was about to say was going to make everything worse, was going to hurt him. I saw her with someone, I said. I just blurted it out, blunt and loud, with no build-up, no context. He stared at me.
When? You saw her on Saturday night? Have you told the police?
No, it was Friday morning, I said, and his shoulders slumped.
But she was fine on Friday. Why is that important?
That pulse in his jaw went again. He was becoming angry.
You saw her with who? With a man?
Yes, I...
What did he look like?
He got to his feet, his body blocking the light.
Have you told the police?
He asked again. I did, but I'm not sure they took me very seriously, I said.
Why?
I don't know. I thought you should know. He leaned forward, his hands on the table, clenched into fists.
What are you saying? You saw her where? What was she doing?
Another deep breath. She was... out on your lawn, I said. Just there. I pointed out to the garden. I saw her from the train. The look of incredulity on his face was unmistakable. I take the train into London from Ashbury every day. I go right past here. I saw her. She was with someone. And it... it wasn't you.
How do you know? Friday morning, Friday... the day before she went missing?
Yes.
I wasn't here, he said. I was away. I was at a conference in Birmingham. I got back on Friday evening.
Spots of colour appeared high on his cheeks, his scepticism giving way to something else.
So you saw her on the lawn with someone? And...
She kissed him, I said. I had to get it out eventually. I had to tell him. They were kissing. He straightened up, his hands still balled into fists, hanging at his sides. The spots of colour on his cheeks grew darker, angrier. I'm sorry, I said. I'm so sorry. I know this is a terrible thing to hear. He held up his hand, waved me away, contemptuous. He wasn't interested in my sympathy. I know how that feels. Sitting there, I remembered with almost perfect clarity how it felt when I sat in my own kitchen, five doors down, while Lara, my former best friend, sat opposite me, her fat toddler squirming on her lap. I remember her telling me how sorry she was that my marriage was over. I remember losing my temper at her platitudes. She knew nothing of my pain. I told her to piss off, and she told me not to speak like that in front of her child. I haven't seen her since.
What did he look like, this man you saw her with?
Scott asked. He was standing with his back to me, looking out onto the lawn. He was tall, taller than you, maybe. Dark-skinned. I think he might have been Asian, Indian, something like that.
And they were kissing? Out here in the garden?
Yes. He gave a long sigh.
Jesus, I need a drink.
He turned to face me.
Would you like a beer?
I did. I wanted a drink desperately. But I said no. I watched as he fetched himself a bottle from the fridge, opened it, took a long slug. I could almost feel the cold liquid sliding down my throat as I watched him. My hand ached for want of a glass. Scott leaned against the counter, his head bent almost to his chest. I felt wretched then. I wasn't helping. I just made him feel worse, increased his pain. I was intruding on his grief. It was wrong. I should never have gone to see him. I should never have lied. Obviously, I should never have lied. I was just getting to my feet when he spoke.
It could... I don't know. It might be a good thing, mightn't it? It could mean that she's all right. She's just...
He gave a hollow little laugh.
She's just run off with someone.
He brushed a tear from his cheek with the back of his hand
and my heart screwed up into a tight little ball.
But the thing is, I can't believe she wouldn't call.
He looked at me as though I held the answers, as though I would know.
Surely she would call me, wouldn't she? She would know how panicked, how desperate I would be. She's not vindictive like that, is she?
He was talking to me like someone he could trust, like Megan's friend, and I knew that it was wrong. But it felt good. He took another swig of his beer and turned towards the garden. I followed his gaze to a little pile of stones against the fence, a rockery long since started and never finished. He raised the bottle halfway to his lips again, and then he stopped. He turned to face me.
"You saw Megan from the train?"
he asked.
"So you were just looking out of the window, and there she was, a woman you happened to know?"
The atmosphere in the room had changed. He wasn't sure anymore, whether I was an ally, whether I was to be trusted. Doubt passed over his face like a shadow.
"Yes, I know where she lives," I said, and I regretted the words the moment they came out of my mouth.
"Where you live, I mean. I've been here before, a long time ago. So sometimes I'd look out for her when I went past." He was staring at me. I could feel the heat rising to my face. "She was often out there." He placed his empty bottle down on the counter, took a couple of steps towards me, and sat down in the seat nearest to me at the table.
"So you knew Megan well then? I mean, well enough to come round to the house?"
I could feel the blood pulsing in my neck, sweat at the base of my spine, the sickening rush of adrenaline. I shouldn't have said that, shouldn't have complicated the lie.
"It was just one time, but I know where the house is because I used to live nearby."
He raised his eyebrows at me.
"Down the road, number 23.
He nodded slowly.
"Watson,"
he said.
"So you're... what? Tom's ex-wife?"
"Yes. I moved out a couple of years ago."
"But you still visited Megan's gallery?"
"Sometimes."
"And when you saw her, what did you... did she talk about personal things? About me?"
His voice was husky.
"About anyone else?"
I shook my head.
"No, no. It was usually just passing the time, you know."
There was a long silence. The heat in the room seemed to build suddenly, the smell of antiseptic rising from every surface. I felt faint. To my right there was a side table adorned with photographs in frames. Megan smiled out at me, cheerfully accusing.
"I should go now," I said. "I've taken up enough of your time."
I started to get up, but he reached an arm out and placed his hand on my wrist, his eyes never leaving my face.
"Don't go just yet,"
he said softly. I didn't stand up, but I withdrew my hand from beneath his. It felt uncomfortably as though I were being restrained.
"This man," he said, "this man you saw her with, do you think you'd recognize him again, if you saw him?"
I couldn't say that I already had identified the man to the police. The whole rationale for approaching him had been that the police hadn't taken my story seriously. If I admitted the truth, the trust would be gone. So I lied again.
"I'm not sure," I said, "but I think I might."
I waited a moment, and then I went on. In the newspapers, there was a quote from a friend of Megan's. His name was Rajesh. I was wondering if... Scott was already shaking his head.
"Rajesh Gujral? I can't see it. He's one of the artists he used to exhibit at the gallery. He's a nice enough guy, but he's married. He's got kids."
As if that meant something.
"Wait a second,"
he said, getting to his feet.
"I think there might be a picture of him somewhere."
He disappeared upstairs. I felt my shoulders drop and realize
that I'd been sitting rigid with tension since I arrived. I looked over at the photographs again. Megan in a sundress on a beach, a close-up of her face, her eyes a startling blue. Just Megan. No pictures of the two of them together. Scott reappeared holding a pamphlet which he presented to me. It was a leaflet advertising a show at the gallery. He turned it over.
There, he said. That's Rajesh.
The man was standing next to a colourful abstract painting. He was older, bearded, short, stocky. It wasn't the man I had seen. The man I had identified to the police.
It's not him, I said.
Scott stood at my side, staring down at the pamphlet, before abruptly turning and marching out of the room and up the stairs again. A few moments later, he came back with a laptop and sat down at the kitchen table.
I think, he said, opening the machine and turning it on. I think I might.
He fell silent, and I watched him, his face a picture of concentration, the muscle in his jaw locked.
Megan was seeing a therapist, he told me. His name is Abdic, Kamal Abdic. He's not Asian, he's from Serbia or Bosnia, somewhere like that. He's dark-skinned, though. He could pass for Indian from a distance.
He tapped away at the computer.
There's a website, I think. I'm sure there is. I think there's a picture.
He spun the laptop round so that I could see the screen. I leaned forward to get a closer look.
That's him, I said. That's definitely him.
Scott snapped the laptop shut. For a long time, he didn't say anything. He sat with his elbows on the table, his forehead resting on his fingertips, his arms trembling.
She was having anxiety attacks, he said at last. Trouble sleeping, things like that. It started last year sometime. I don't remember when exactly.
He talked without looking at me, as though he were talking to himself, as though he'd forgotten I was there at all.
I was the one who suggested she talk to someone. I was the one who encouraged her to go because I didn't seem to be able to help her.
His voice cracked a little then.
I couldn't help her. And she told me that she'd had similar problems in the past and that eventually they'd go away. But I made her. I persuaded her to go to the doctor. That guy was recommended to her.
He gave a little cough to clear his throat.
The therapy seemed to be helping. She was happier.
He gave a short, sad laugh.
Now I know why.
I reached out my hand to give him a pat on the arm, a gesture of comfort. Abruptly, he drew away and got to his feet.
You should go, he said brusquely. My mother will be here soon. She won't leave me alone for more than an hour or two.
At the door, just as I was leaving, he caught hold of my arm.
Have I seen you somewhere before?
He asked. For a moment, I thought about saying, You might have done. You might have seen me at the police station, or here on the street. I was here on Saturday night. I shook my head. No, I don't think so. I walked away towards the train station as quickly as I could. About halfway along the street, I turned to look back. He was still standing there in the doorway, watching me. Evening. I've been checking my email obsessively, but I've heard nothing from Tom. How much better life must have been for jealous drunks before emails and texts and mobile phones, before all this electronica and the traces it leaves. There was almost nothing in the papers about Megan today. They're moving on already. The front page is devoted to the political crisis in Turkey, the four-year-old girl mauled by dogs in Wigan, the England football team's humiliating loss to Montenegro. Megan is being forgotten, and she's only been gone a week. Kathy invited me out to lunch. She was at a loose end because Damien has gone to visit his mother in Birmingham. She wasn't invited. They've been seeing each other for almost 2 years now, and she still hasn't met his mother. We went to Giraffe on the high street, a place I loathe. Seated in the centre of a room heaving with shrieking under-fives, Cathy quizzed me about what I'd been up to. She was curious about where I was last night. "Have you met someone?" she asked me, her eyes alight with hope. It was quite touching, really. I almost said yes, because it was the truth. But lying was easier. I told her I'd been to an AA meeting in Whitney. "Oh," she said, embarrassed, dipping her eyes to her limp Greek salad. "I thought you'd maybe had a little slip on Friday." "Yes. It won't be plain sailing, Cathy," I said. And I felt awful, because I think she really cares whether I get sober or not. "But I'm doing my best." "If you need me to, you know, come with you." "Not at this stage," I said. "But thank you." "Well, maybe we could do something else together. Like go to the gym?" she asked. I laughed, but when I realized she was being serious, I said I'd think about it. "She's just left. Damien rang to say he was back from his mother's, so she's gone round to his place. I thought about saying something to her. Why do you go running to him whenever he calls? But I'm really not in a great position to give relationship advice, or any advice come to that. And in any case, I feel like a drink. I've been thinking about it ever since we sat down in Giraffe, and the spotty waiter asked if we'd like a glass of wine, and Cathy said, "No, thank you," very firmly. So I wave her off, and feel the little anticipatory tingle run over my skin, and I push away the good thoughts. "Don't do this. You're doing really well." I'm just putting my shoes on to go to the off-license, and my phone rings. "Tom. It'll be Tom." I grab the phone from my bag and look at the screen, and my heart bangs like a drum. "Hi." There is silence, so I ask, "Is everything okay?" After a little pause, Scott says,
"Yeah, fine. I'm okay. I just called to say thank you for yesterday, for taking the time to let me know."
"Oh, that's all right. You didn't need..."
"Am I disturbing you?"
"No, it's fine." There is silence on the end of the line, so I say again, "It's fine. Has something happened? Did you speak to the police?"
"The family liaison officer was here this afternoon," he says.
My heart rate quickens.
"Detective Sergeant Riley. I mentioned Kamal Abdich to her. Told her that he might be worth speaking to."
"You said... you told her that you'd spoken to me?" My mouth is completely dry.
"No, I didn't. I thought perhaps... I don't know. I thought it would be better if I came up with a name myself. I said... it's a lie, I know, but I said that I'd been racking my brains to think of anything significant, and that I thought it might be worth speaking to her therapist. I said that I'd had some concerns about their relationship in the past."
I can breathe again. "What did she say?" I ask him.
"She said they had already spoken to him, but that they would do again. She asked me lots of questions about why I hadn't mentioned him before. She's... I don't know. I don't trust her. She's supposed to be on my side, but all the time I feel like she's snooping, like she's trying to trip me up."
I'm stupidly pleased that he doesn't like her either. Another thing we have in common. Another thread to bind us.
"I just wanted to say thank you, anyway, for coming forward. It was actually... it sounds odd, but it was good to talk to someone. Someone I'm not close to. I felt as though I could think more rationally. After you left, I kept thinking about the first time Megan went to see him, Abdich, about the way she was when she came back. There was something about her. A lightness."
He exhales loudly.
"I don't know. Maybe I'm imagining it."
I have the same feeling I did yesterday, that he's no longer really talking to me, he's just talking. I've become a sounding board, and I'm glad of it. I'm glad to be of use to him.
"I've spent the whole day going through Megan's things again," he said. "I've already searched our room, the whole house, half a dozen times, looking for something, anything that would give me an indication as to where she could be. Something from him,
perhaps. But there's nothing. No emails, no letters, nothing. I thought about trying to contact him, but the practice is closed today, and I can't find a mobile number.
Is that a good idea, do you think? I ask. I mean, do you not think you should just leave him to the police? I don't want to say it out loud, but we must both be thinking it. He's dangerous, or at least he could be dangerous.
I don't know. I just don't know.
There's a desperate edge to his voice that's painful to hear, but I have no comfort to offer. I can hear his breathing on the other end of the line. It sounds short, quickened, as though he's afraid. I want to ask him if he has someone there with him, but I can't. It would sound wrong, forward.
I saw your ex today,
he says, and I can feel the hairs on my arms stand up. Oh?
Yes. I went out for the papers and saw him on the street. He asked me if I was all right, whether there was any news.
Oh, I repeat, because it's all I can say. Words won't form.
I don't want him to speak to Tom. Tom knows that I don't know Megan Hipwell. Tom knows that I was on Blenheim Road the night she disappeared.
I didn't mention you. I didn't, you know. I wasn't sure if I should have mentioned that I'd met you.
No, I don't think you should have. I don't know. It might be awkward.
All right,
he says. After that, there's a long silence. I'm waiting for my heartbeat to slow. I think he's going to ring off, but then he says,
Did she really never talk about me?
Of course. Of course she did, I say. I mean, we didn't talk all that often, but...
But you came to the house. Megan hardly ever invites people round. She's really private, protective of her own space.
I'm searching for a reason. I wish I had never told him I'd been to the house. I just came round to borrow a book.
Really?
He doesn't believe me. She's not a reader. I think of the house. There were no books on the shelves there.
What sort of things did she say? About me?
Well, she was very happy, I say. With you, I mean. Your relationship. As I'm saying this, I realise how odd it sounds, but I can't be specific, and so I try to save myself. To be honest with you, I was having a really hard time in my marriage, so I think it was a kind of compare and contrast thing. She lit up when she spoke about you.
What an awful cliché. Did she?
He doesn't seem to notice. There's a note of wistfulness in his voice.
That's so good to hear.
He pauses, and I can hear his breathing, quick and shallow, on the other end of the line.
We had a terrible argument,
he says,
the night she left. I hate the idea that she was angry with me when...
He tails off. I'm sure she wasn't angry with you for long, I say. Couples fight. Couples fight all the time.
But this was bad. It was terrible, and I can't... I feel like I can't tell anyone, because if I did, they would look at me like I was guilty.
There's a different quality to his voice now. Haunted, saturated with guilt.
I don't remember how it started,
he says, and immediately I don't believe him. But then I think about all the arguments I've forgotten, and I bite my tongue.
It got very heated. I was unkind to her. I was a bastard. A complete bastard. She was upset. She went upstairs and put some things in a bag. I don't know what exactly, but I noticed later that her toothbrush was gone, so I knew she wasn't planning on coming home. I thought she must have gone to Tara's for the night. That happened once before, just one time. It wasn't like this happened all the time. I didn't even go after her,
he says, and it hits me yet again that he's not really talking to me. He's confessing. He's on one side of the confessional, and I'm on the other, faceless, unseen.
I just let her go.
That was on Saturday night?
Yes. That was the last time I saw her.
There was a witness who saw her, or saw a woman fitting her description, walking towards Whitney Station at around 7:15. I know that from the newspaper reports. That was the final sighting. No one remembered seeing her on the platform or on the train. There is no CCTV at Whitney, and she wasn't picked up on the CCTV at Corley, although the report said that this didn't prove she wasn't there because there are significant blind spots at that station. What time was it when you tried to contact her? I ask him. Another long silence.
I went to the pub. The Rose, you know, just around the corner on Kingly Road. I needed to cool down to get things straight in my head. I had a couple of pints and I went back home. That was just before 10. I think I was hoping that she'd have had time to calm down and that she'd be back. But she wasn't.
So it was around 10 o'clock when you tried to call her?
No.
His voice is little more than a whisper now.
I didn't. I drank a couple more beers at home. I watched some TV. Then I went to bed.
I think about all the arguments I had with Tom. All the terrible things I said after I'd had too much. All the storming out into the street, shouting at him, telling him I never wanted to see him again. He always rang me. He always talked me down, coaxed me home.
I just imagined she'd be sitting in Tara's kitchen, you know, talking about what a shit I am. So I left it.
He left it. It sounds callous and uncaring, and I'm not surprised he hasn't told this story to anyone else. I'm surprised that he's telling anyone at all. This is not the Scott I imagined, the Scott I knew, the one who stood behind Megan on the terrace, his big hands on her bony shoulders, ready to protect her from anything. I'm ready to hang up the phone, but Scott keeps talking.
I woke up early. There were no messages on my phone. I didn't panic. I assumed she was with Tara and that she was still angry with me. I rang her then and got her voicemail, but I still didn't panic. I thought she was probably still asleep or just ignoring me. I couldn't find Tara's number, but I had her address. It was on a business card on Megan's desk. So I got up and I drove round there.
I wonder if he wasn't worried why he felt he needed to go round to Tara's house, but I don't interrupt. I let him talk.
I got to Tara's place a little after 9. It took her a while to come to the door, but when she did, she looked really surprised to see me. It was obvious that I was the last person she expected to see on her doorstep at that time in the morning. And that's when I knew. That's when I knew that Megan wasn't there. And I started to think. I started...
The words catch, and I feel wretched for doubting him.
She told me the last time she'd seen Megan was at their Pilates class on Friday night. That's when I started to panic.
After I hang up the phone, I think about how, if you didn't know him, if you hadn't seen how he was with her, as I have, a lot of what he'd said would not ring quite true. Monday, the 22nd of July, 2013. Morning. I feel quite befuddled. I slept soundly but dreamily, and this morning I am struggling to wake up properly. The hot weather has returned, and the carriage is stifling today, despite being only half full. I was late getting up this morning, and didn't have time to pick up a newspaper or to check the news on the internet before I left the house. So I am trying to get the BBC site on my phone, but for some reason it is taking forever to load. At Northcote, a man with an iPad gets on and takes the seat next to me. He has no problems at all getting the news up. He goes straight to the Daily Telegraph site, and there it is, in big, bold letters, the third story. Man arrested in connection with Megan Hipwell disappearance. I get such a fright that I forget myself and lean right over to get a better look. He looks up at me, affronted, almost startled.
I'm sorry, I say. I know her, the missing woman. I know her.
Oh, how awful, he says. He's a middle-aged man, well-spoken and well-dressed.
Would you like to read the story?
Please, I can't get anything to come up on my phone.
He smiles kindly and hands me the tablet. I touch the headline, and the story comes up. A man in his 30s has been arrested in connection with the disappearance of Megan Hipwell, 29, the Whitney woman who has been missing since Saturday, the 13th of July. Police were not able to confirm whether the man arrested is Megan Hipwell's husband, Scott Hipwell, who was questioned under caution on Friday. In a statement this morning, a police spokesman said, "We can confirm that we have arrested a man in connection with Megan's disappearance. He has not yet been charged with an offence. The search for Megan continues, and we are searching an address which we believe may be a crime scene." We are passing the house now. For once, the train has not stopped at the signal. I whip my head around, but I'm too late. It's gone. My hands are trembling as I hand the iPad back to its owner. He shakes his head sadly.
"I'm very sorry,"
he says.
"She isn't dead,"
I say. My voice is a croak, and even I don't believe me. Tears are stinging the back of my eyes. I was in his house. I was there. I sat across the table from him. I looked into his eyes. I felt something. I think about those huge hands and about how, if he could crush me, he could destroy her. Tiny, fragile Megan. The brakes screech as we approach Whitney Station, and I leap to my feet.
"I have to go,"
I tell the man next to me, who looks a little surprised, but nods sagely.
"Good luck,"
he says. I run along the platform and down the stairs. I'm going against the flow of people, and I'm almost at the bottom of the stairs when I stumble and a man says,
"Watch it."
I don't glance up at him, because I'm looking at the edge of the concrete step, the second to last one. There's a smear of blood on it. I wonder how long it's been there. Could it be a week old? Could it be my blood? Hers? Is her blood in the house, I wonder? Is that why they've arrested him? I try to picture the kitchen, the living room. The smell. Very clean, antiseptic. Was that bleach? I don't know. I can't remember now. All I can remember, clearly, is the sweat on his back and the beer on his breath. I run past the underpass, stumbling at the corner of Blenheim Road. I'm holding my breath as I hurry along the pavement, head down, too afraid to look up. But when I do, there's nothing to see. There are no vans parked outside Scott's house. No police cars. Could they have finished searching the house already? If they had found something, they would still be there, surely. It must take hours, going over everything, processing the evidence. I quicken my pace. When I get to his house, I stop. Take a deep breath. The curtains are drawn, upstairs and down. The curtains in the neighbour's window twitch. I'm being watched. I step into the doorway, my hand raised. I shouldn't be here. I don't know what I'm doing here. I just wanted to see. I wanted to know. I'm caught, for a moment, between going against my every instinct and knocking on that door and turning away. I turn to leave, and it's at that moment that the door opens. Before I have time to move, his hand shoots out. He grabs my forearm and pulls me towards him. His mouth is a grim line, his eyes wild. He is desperate. Flooded with dread and adrenaline, I see darkness coming. I open my mouth to cry out, but I'm too late. He yanks me into the house and slams the door behind me.
Megan. Thursday the 21st of March 2013. Morning. I don't lose. He should know this about me. I don't lose games like this. The screen on my phone is blank. Stubbornly, insolently blank. No text messages. No missed calls. Every time I look at it, it feels like I've been slapped and I get angrier and angrier. What happened to me in that hotel room? What was I thinking? That we made a connection, that there was something real between us. He has no intention of going anywhere with me. But I believed him for a second. More than a second. And that's what really pisses me off. I was ridiculous. Credulous. He was laughing at me all along. If he thinks I'm going to sit around crying over him, he's got another thing coming. I can live without him. I can do without him. Just fine. But I don't like to lose. It's not like me. None of this is like me. I don't get rejected. I'm the one who walks away. I'm driving myself insane. I can't help it. I can't stop going back to that afternoon at the hotel and going over and over what he said. The way he made me feel. Bastard. If he thinks I will just disappear, go quietly, he's mistaken. If he doesn't pick up soon, I'm going to stop calling his mobile and call him at home. I'm not just going to be ignored. At breakfast, Scott asks me to cancel my therapy session. I don't say anything. I pretend I haven't heard him. Dave's asked us round to dinner, he says. We haven't been over there for ages. Can you rearrange your session? His tone is light, as though this is a casual request, but I can feel him watching me, his eyes on my face. We're on the edge of an argument, and I have to be careful. I can't, Scott, it's too late, I say. Why don't you ask Dave and Karen to come here on Saturday instead? Just the thought of entertaining Dave and Karen at the weekend is wearing, but I'm going to have to compromise. It's not too late, he says, putting his coffee cup down on the table in front of me. He rests his hand on my shoulder for just a moment, says, cancel it, okay? And walks out of the room. The second the front door closes, I pick up the coffee cup and hurl it against the wall. Evening. I could tell myself that it's not really a rejection. I could try to persuade myself that he's just trying to do the right thing, morally and professionally. But I know that isn't true. Or at least it's not the whole truth, because if you want someone badly enough, morals, and certainly professionalism, don't come into it. You'll do anything to have them. He just doesn't want me badly enough. I ignored Scott's calls all afternoon. I turned up to my session late and walked straight into his office without a word to the receptionist. He was sitting at his desk, writing something. He glanced up at me when I walked in, didn't smile, then looked back down at his papers. I stood in front of his desk, waiting for him to look at me. It felt like forever before he did. Are you okay? He asked eventually. He smiled at me then. You're late. The breath was catching in my throat. I couldn't speak. I walked around the desk and leaned against it, my leg brushing against his thigh. He drew back a little. Megan, he said, are you all right? I shook my head. I put my hand out to him and he took it. Megan, he said again, shaking his head. I didn't say anything. You can't. You should sit down, he said. Let's talk. I shook my head. Megan. Every time he said my name, he made it worse. He got to his feet and circled the desk, walking away from me. He stood in the middle of the room. Come on, he said, his voice businesslike, brusque even. Sit down. I followed him into the middle of the room, put one hand on his waist, the other against his chest. He held me by my wrists and moved away from me. Don't, Megan, you can't, we can't. He turned away. Kamal, I said, my voice catching. I hated the sound of it. Please. This here is not appropriate. It's normal, believe me, but I told him then that I wanted to be with him. It's transference, Megan, he said. It happens from time to time. It happens to me too. I really should have introduced this topic last time, I'm sorry. I wanted to scream then. He made it sound so banal, so bloodless, so common. Are you telling me you feel nothing? I asked him. You're saying I'm imagining all this. He shook his head. You have to understand, Megan, I shouldn't have let things get this far. I moved closer to him, put my hands on his hips, and turned him around. He took hold of my arms again, his long fingers locked around my wrists. I could lose my job, he said. And then I really lost my temper. I pulled away, angry, violently. He tried to hold me, but he couldn't. I was yelling at him, telling him I didn't give a shit about his job. He was trying to quiet me, worried, I assume, about what the receptionist thought, what the other patients thought. He grabbed hold of my shoulders, his thumbs digging into the flesh at the top of my arms, and told me to calm down, to stop behaving like a child. He shook me, hard. I thought for a moment he was going to slap my face. I kissed him, on the mouth. I bit his lower lip as hard as I could. I could taste his blood in my mouth. He pushed me away. I plotted revenge on my way home. I was thinking of all the things I could do to him. I could get him fired, or worse. I won't, though, because I like him too much. I don't want to hurt him. I'm not even that upset about the rejection anymore. What bothers me most is that I haven't got to the end of my story. And I can't start over with someone else, it's too hard. I don't want to go home now, because I don't know how I'm going to be able to explain the bruises on my arms.
Rachel. Monday the 22nd of July, 2013. Evening. And now, I wait. It's agonizing, the not knowing. The slowness with which everything is bound to move. But there's nothing more to do. I was right, this morning, when I felt that dread. I just didn't know what I had to be afraid of. Not Scott. When he pulled me inside, he must have seen the terror in my eyes, because almost immediately, he let go of me. Wild-eyed and disheveled, he seemed to shrink back from the light and close the doors behind us.
What are you doing here? There are photographers, journalists, everywhere. I can't have people coming to the door, hanging around. They'll say things. They'll try anything to get pictures, to get...
There's no one out there, I said, though to be honest, I hadn't really looked. There might have been people sitting in cars, waiting for something to happen.
What are you doing here?
He demanded again.
I heard... It was on the news. I just wanted... Is it him? Have they arrested him?
He nodded.
Yes, early this morning. The family liaison person was here. She came to tell me. But she couldn't... They won't tell me why. They must have found something, but they won't tell me what. It's not her, though. I know they haven't found her.
He sits down on the stairs and wraps his arms around himself. His whole body is trembling.
I can't stand it. I can't stand waiting for the phone to ring. When the phone rings, what will it be? Will it be the worst news? Will it be...
He tails off, then looks up as though he's seeing me for the first time.
Why did you come?
I wanted... I thought you wouldn't want to be alone.
He looked at me as though I was insane.
I'm not alone, he said.
He got up and pushed past me into the living room. For a moment, I just stood there. I didn't know whether to follow him or to leave. But then he called out.
Do you want a coffee?
There was a woman outside on the lawn, smoking. Tall, with salt-and-pepper hair. She was smartly dressed in black trousers and white blouse, done up to the throat. She was pacing up and down the patio. But as soon as she caught sight of me, she stopped, flicked her cigarette onto the paving stones, and crushed it beneath her toe.
Police?
She asked me doubtfully as she entered the kitchen.
No, I'm...
This is Rachel Watson, Mum, Scott said. The woman who contacted me about Abditch.
She nodded slowly, as though Scott's explanation didn't really help her. She took me in, her gaze sweeping rapidly over me from head to toe and back again.
Oh. I
didn't have a justifiable reason for being there. I couldn't say, could I? I just wanted to know. I wanted to see.
Well, Scott is very grateful to you for coming forward.
We're obviously waiting now to find out what exactly is going on. She stepped towards me, took me by the elbow, and turned me gently towards the front door. I glanced at Scott, but he wasn't looking at me. His gaze was fixed somewhere out of the window, across the tracks. Thank you for stopping by, Mrs. Watson. We really are very grateful to you. I found myself on the doorstep. The front door closed firmly behind me. And when I looked up, I saw them. Tom pushing a buggy, and Anna at his side. They stopped dead when they saw me. Anna raised her hand to her mouth and swooped down to grab her child. The lioness protecting her cub. I wanted to laugh at her, to tell her, I'm not here for you. I couldn't be less interested in your daughter. I'm cast out. Scott's mother made that clear. I'm cast out, and I'm disappointed. But it shouldn't matter, because they have Kamal Abdich. They've got him. And I helped. I did something right. They've got him. And it can't be long now before they find Megan and bring her home.
Anna. Monday, the 22nd of July, 2013. Morning. Tom woke me up early with a kiss and a cheeky grin. He has a late meeting this morning, so he suggested we take Evie around the corner for breakfast. It's a place where we used to meet when we first started seeing each other. We'd sit in the window. She was at work in London, so there was no danger of her walking past and noticing us. But there was that thrill, even so. Perhaps she'd come home early for some reason. Perhaps she'd be feeling ill or have forgotten some vital papers. I dreamed of it. I willed her to come along one day, to see him with me, to know in an instant that he was no longer hers. It's hard to believe now that there was once a time when I wanted her to appear. Since Megan went missing, I've avoided walking this way whenever possible. It gives me the creeps passing that house. But to get to the cafe, it's the only route. Tom walks a little way ahead of me, pushing the buggy. He's singing something to Evie, making her laugh. I love it when we're out like this, the three of us. I can see the way people look at us. I can see them thinking, what a beautiful family. It makes me proud, prouder than I've ever been of anything in my life. So I'm sailing along in my bubble of happiness, and we're almost at number 15 when the door opens. For a moment I think I'm hallucinating, because she walks out. Rachel. She comes out of the front door and stands there for a second, sees us and stops dead. It's horrible. She gives us the strangest smile, a grimace almost. And I can't help myself. I lunge forward and grab Evie out of her buggy, startling her in the process. She starts to cry. Rachel walks quickly away from us towards the station. Tom calls after her. Rachel? What are you doing here? Rachel! But she keeps going faster and faster until she's almost running, and the two of us just stand there. Then Tom turns to me, and with one glance at the expression on my face says, Come on, let's just go home. Evening. We found out when we got home that they've arrested someone in connection with Megan Hipwell's disappearance. Some guy I'd never heard of, a therapist she'd been seeing. It was a relief, I suppose, because I'd been imagining all sorts of awful things. I told you it wouldn't be a stranger, Tom said. It never is it? In any case, we don't even know what's happened. She's probably fine. She's probably run off with someone. So why have they arrested that man, then? He shrugged. He was distracted, pulling on his jacket, straightening his tie, getting ready to go and meet the day's last client. What are we going to do? I asked him. Do? He looked at me blankly. About her. Rachel. Why was she here? Why was she at the Hipwells' house? Do you think she was trying to get into our garden? You know, going through the neighbours' gardens? Tom gave a grim laugh. I doubt it. Come on, this is Rachel we're talking about. She wouldn't be able to haul her fat ass over all those fences. I've no idea what she was doing there. Maybe she was pissed, went to the wrong door. In other words, she meant to come round here. He shook his head. I don't know. Look, don't worry about it, okay? Keep the doors locked. I'll give her a ring and find out what she's up to. I think we should call the police. And say what? She hasn't actually done anything. She hasn't done anything lately, unless you count the fact that she was here the night Megan Hipwell disappeared, I said. We should have told the police about her ages ago. Anna, come on. He slipped his arm around my waist. I hardly think Rachel has anything to do with Megan Hipwell going missing. But I'll talk to her, okay? But you said after last time... I know, he said softly. I know what I said. He kissed me, slipped his hand into the waistband of my jeans. Let's not get the police involved, unless we really need to. I think we do need to. I can't stop thinking about that smile she gave us. That sneer. It was almost triumphant. We need to get away from here. We need to get away from her.
Rachel, Tuesday, the 23rd of July, 2013. Morning. It takes me a while to realize what I'm feeling when I wake. There's a rush of elation, tempered with something else. A nameless dread. I know we're close to finding the truth. I just can't help feeling that the truth is going to be terrible. I sit up in bed and grab my laptop, turn it on, and wait impatiently for it to boot up. Then log on to the internet. The whole process seems interminable. I can hear Kathy moving around the house, washing up her breakfast things, running upstairs to brush her teeth. She hovers for a few moments outside my door. I imagine her knuckles raised, ready to rap. She thinks better of it and runs back down the stairs. The BBC news page comes up. The headline is about benefit cuts. The second story about yet another 1970s television star accused of sexual indiscretions. Nothing about Megan. Nothing about Kamal. I'm disappointed. I know that the police have 24 hours to charge a suspect, and they've had that now. In some circumstances, they can hold someone for an extra 12 hours, though. I know all this because I spent yesterday doing my research. After I was shown out of Scott's house, I came back here, turned on the television, and spent most of the day watching the news, reading articles online. Waiting. By midday, the police had named their suspect. On the news, they talked about evidence discovered at Dr. Abdich's house and in his car, but they didn't say what. Blood, perhaps? Her phone, as yet undiscovered? Clothes, a bag, her toothbrush? They kept showing pictures of Kamal, close-ups of his dark, handsome face. The picture they use isn't a mugshot. It's a candid shot. He's on holiday somewhere, not quite smiling, but almost. He looks too soft, too beautiful to be a killer. But appearances can be deceptive. They say Ted Bundy looked like Cary Grant. I waited all day for more news, for the charges to be made public. Kidnap, assault, or worse. I waited to hear where she is, where he's been keeping her. They showed pictures of Blenheim Road, the station, Scott's front door. Commentators mused on the likely implications of the fact that neither Megan's phone nor her bank cards had been used for more than a week. Tom called more than once. I didn't pick up. I know what he wants. He wants to ask why I was at Scott Hipwell's house yesterday morning. Let him wonder. It has nothing to do with him. Not everything is about him. I imagine he's calling at her behest in any case. I don't owe her any explanations. I waited and waited, and still no charge. Instead, we heard more about Kamal, the trusted mental health professional who listened to Megan's secrets and troubles, who gained her trust and then abused it, who seduced her, and then, who knows what? I learned that he is a Muslim, a Bosniak, a survivor of the Balkans conflict, who came to Britain as a 15-year-old refugee. No stranger to violence, he lost his father and two elder brothers at Srebrenica. He has a conviction for domestic violence. The more I heard about Kamal, the more I knew that I was right. I was right to speak to the police about him. I was right to contact Scott. I get up and pull my dressing gown around me, hurry downstairs and flick on the TV. I have no intention of going anywhere today. If Kathy comes home unexpectedly, I can tell her I'm ill. I make myself a cup of coffee and sit down in front of the television. And I wait. Evening. I got bored around 3 o'clock. I got bored with hearing about benefits and 70s TV paedophiles. I got frustrated with hearing nothing about Megan, nothing about Kamal. So I went to the off-license and bought 2 bottles of white wine. I'm almost at the bottom of the first bottle when it happens. There's something else on the news now. Shaky camera footage taken from a half-built or half-destroyed building. Explosions in the distance. Syria or Egypt. Maybe Sudan. I've got the sound down. I'm not really paying attention. Then I see it. The ticker, running across the bottom of the screen, tells me that the government is facing a challenge to legal aid cuts, and that Fernando Torres will be out for up to 4 weeks with a hamstring strain, and that the suspect in the Megan Hipwell disappearance has been released without charge. I put my glass down and grab the remote, clicking the volume button up, up, up. This can't be right. The war report continues. It goes on and on, my blood pressure rising with it. But eventually, it ends, and they go back to the studio, and the newsreader says,
Kamal Abdic, the man arrested yesterday in connection with the disappearance of Megan Hipwell, has been released without charge. Abdic, who was Mrs. Hipwell's therapist, was detained yesterday, but was released this morning because police say there is insufficient evidence to charge him.
I don't hear what she says after that. I just sit there, my eyes blurring over, a wash of noise in my ears, thinking, they had him. They had him, and they let him go. Upstairs, later, I've had too much to drink. I can't see the computer screen properly. Everything doubles, trebles. I can read if I hold my hand over one eye. It gives me a headache. Kathy is home, she called out to me, and I told her I was in bed, unwell. She knows that I'm drinking. My belly is awash with alcohol. I feel sick. I can't think straight. Shouldn't have started drinking so early. Shouldn't have started drinking at all. I phoned Scott's number an hour ago, again a few minutes ago. Shouldn't have done that either. I just want to know. What lies has Kamal told them? What lies have they been fool enough to believe? The police have messed the whole thing up. Idiots. That Riley woman, her fault, I'm sure of it. The newspapers haven't helped. There was no domestic violence conviction, they're saying now. That was a mistake. They're making him look like the victim. Don't want to drink any more. I know that I should pour the rest down the sink. Because otherwise, it'll be there in the morning, and I'll get up and drink it straight away. And once I've started, I want to go on. I should pour it down the sink, but I know I'm not going to. Something to look forward to in the morning. It's dark, and I can hear someone calling her name. A voice, low at first, but then louder. Angry, desperate, calling Megan's name. It's Scott. He's unhappy with her. He calls her again and again. It's a dream, I think. I keep trying to grasp at it, to hold on to it, but the harder I struggle, the fainter and the further away it gets. Wednesday, the 24th of July, 2013. Morning. I'm woken by a soft tapping at the door. Rain batters against the windows. It's after 8, but still seems dark outside. Kathy pushes the door gently open and peers into the room.
Rachel?